Thousands of tons of water, mud and sand blackened the gigantic fireball. Rear Admiral Torres, who was in command of the operation, and Dr. Penny turned to watch the great cloud after its initial blinding flash was over. Somewhere out there, the ship carrying the weapon had been vaporized. The spectacular success of the operation furthers our hopes of peace. For it seems that by the possession of such deadly weapons, peace can be maintained in this troubled world.
Jim, he just wrote about it. He just talked about it. He saw the pictures of it. But Jim Marlowe, the Secretary of the Australian Ex-Services Atomic Survivors Association, was aboard HMAS Kerangi near the Montebellos for one of those nuclear tests. Jim, good morning to you. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you.
Hey, Jim, it's really good to talk to you. Firstly, what was it like to receive this news that after so many years, and it may be argued far too late to be of significant value to people, there is finally this recognition of what you fellas endured?
First of all, it was far too late to many people. I couldn't begin to count the number of people who've gone in the matter in relation to these tests and gone without a bleak future for many years first and then died out without anything. The biggest problem, of course, with the whole thing is that the government is faced with a catch-22 situation. They were led into an agreement with the British government by a pack of half-truths and lies and then kept in the dark like a little plant after all for many years.
Like the deferential country we were?
Yeah, we were, and I can understand both yes. sides of the question. I mean, the things that weren't known about nuclear power far outweighed those who did know, and still do probably. And of course, it means that if you're having to do any thoughts at all about this being a problem in your future, which indeed Prime Minister Clem Attlee and Bob Menzies did both have the same feeling that they were being left out of the atomic race, and they were being left in a situation where they couldn't ignore it. And as a consequence, the only choice they had was to look forward to a place like Australia to be their test program. Now, I don't really condone, or I don't even make any allowances for what was done on both sides. Apart from the fact that Britain led Australia by the nose, and Australia was too silly to do anything different.
True. I guess the other point, though, the hindsight observation, or the one you've been living with, we've known for many, many, many years of the kind of risks that you were exposed to, and this gold card has come very, very late. But, Jim, I wonder if you will take us back to that time to tell us what you did and what you saw.
Well, it was a long time ago, of course, and we were all very young, as you can understand, at that time of the game. I think I was about 18, 19 or 20 or something. Very, very much in the dark as to nuclear power. I mean, the atomic tests, the atomic bombs dropped in Japan were just a bit of headlines in the newspaper to us in those days. You can remember your own life probably back in the teenagers. You didn't really take much attention to world affairs at that time of the game. When we got there, we were a lot of us were young fellas and enjoying ourselves. Some of us were a little older. We were just making an average day at sea. Whatever ship you're on, whatever your tasks are, you just get around doing your work.
Yes.
There's little else to do anyway. And when the time came for the test, we were lined up on deck of a ship I was on, which was a single deck really, and told to turn our backs towards this, the island itself. The explosion itself was, first of all, a blinding flash of white light, which penetrated my eyelids anyway. I could see through my eyelids. I don't know about my wrists, my bones and my hand. I didn't look that far, but that coincided with a tremendous clap of noise from the island and echo, and then followed up by a harsh wind, which was quite a screeching wind, and by that time, we'd been told to turn our face back to towards the island again, and we watched this cloud billowing up into the sky, a cloud of dust and you name it, everything was in every colour in the world and every bit of dirt in the world. It spiralled up to a certain extent, and in some cases it formed, in some high views, they formed a mushroom, and in some cases it just disappeared up, affected by the high winds and carried away. At that point in time, we'd basically lost interest because that's all we knew about it. There's no follow-up in terms of report from the island by radio, just a case of the bomb, and then we looked at it for a while and then just went about our work.
So, Jim, on the basis of what you would learn over the decades and the deaths of people that you went to work with that day, what conclusion did you draw about the impact of that radiation on your lives?
Well, it hadn't affected me really at that time, and there's a lot of people hadn't affected that time because it was a very slow building or enemy, I suppose you could call it. And it doesn't affect you in early life because it's so slow. Some people get a very quick reaction to it and were immediately struck down with unknown sicknesses of some sort, and they manifest themselves just in feeling sick, and they were obviously unfit for duty, and some were just carried away to hospital somewhere, and basically they were never heard more of them really. And in the busyness of the day and the lack of interest, I suppose, or lack of interest or knowledge in the atomic testing, led us to just sort of get over the immediate problem of it and get on with our own work and say, well, you know, Jack's gone, he will see him somewhere else, I suppose.